So yes, thank you very much for Kurt and Rachel for inviting me here and for giving me the opportunity to open the ceremonies today. So yes, I'm going to talk about propagation of massive gravity waves in a background field. That's basically what I'm going to do is linearize DRGT massive gravity over some background solution and see what happens. So first, let me start by motivating what I'm going to do. So in general, when we want to look at higher spin theories, we have a bunch of consistency conditions, and they are, of course, that we want the proper number of degrees of freedom to propagate. We want the model to be stable. In particular, we want it to have no ghosts. Then, of course, we want the model to actually be able to predict stuff, so we want it to be hyperbolic. And finally, and that's probably the main topic of this workshop, is we usually want subliminal propagation of such models. So in general, it's very hard to construct higher spin theories that obey these consistency conditions. And in particular for massive spin 2, there was a lot of progress made in the past 5 years. In particular, since Duram, Gabaretsa, and Tolley showed there existed this particular form of massive gravity theory that actually propagated the right number of degrees of freedom. So that the first consistency condition is true. And also, since in general for massive spin two, the spurious degree of freedom is a ghost, this also showed that the model has no ghost. It's what's called the Bulwer desert ghost usually. However, ever since the beginning of these theories, people knew that they had superluminal propagation, in particular since Galileans were shown to propagate superluminally. And Galileans are basically appear in a particular decoupling limit of DRGT massive gravity. So what we did with Stanley Deser, McCallum Sandora, and Andrew Waldron is try to do a nonlinear propagation analysis of DRGT massive gravity. And we had some results that we present in this paper. And now also we are trying to give an easier interpretation of these results in a work that is now in progress and almost done. So how I'm going to try to make sense of propagation properties of DRGT massive gravity is in the following way. So first of all, I'm going to take an MGR solution and linearize perturbations over this MGR solution. Then look at the covariant constraints that exist for these perturbations. Compute the characteristic matrix, which I'm going to explain what it is for these perturbations. And then show that we can make an analogy with charged spin 3/2 models, in particular the one that's been introduced by Rita and Schwinger, and try to basically infer analogous propagation properties as the ones that were found to happen in charged spin 3/2 models by Velo and Zwanziger in the 70s. So in particular, we will be able to say something about hyperbolicity requirements and superluminality and causal structures. So I'm going to start by presenting what DRGT massive gravity is and in a particular framework that we worked on and show that how you can compute the different constraints covariantly. Then I'm going to do this perturbative analysis that I just talked about. And then I'm going to show how this allows us to make an analogy with spin 3/2. So let's start with the general theory. So I'm going to look at a particular formulation of DRGT massive gravity, which is its Fierbein formulation. And moreover, I'm going to look at its Fierbein formulation in first order Cartan formalism. So that means that I consider that the four Fierbein 1 forms, EM, and the six connection 1 forms, omega MN in four dimensions, are independent fields, and I'm going to vary the action independently with respect to these two sets of fields. So as many of you know probably, the DRGT action as a function of these variables is expressed with the help of this fiducial one-form field, which is Fm, and corresponds to the fiducial metric, basically, in the usual metric formulation of DRGT. And it is just the sum of this Einstein-Hilbert or Hilbert-Palatini term. No, Hilbert-Palatini term in this case. And this mass term, which is basically a product of E's and F's with a bunch of parameters. I just have to say here that since the main variables we are working with are form fields, you have to understand that there are wedge products everywhere where forms appear. So I just didn't write them because it wouldn't fit on one slide. Okay, so now I'm going to quickly talk about how you can compute covariant constraints for this theory and show that there are the proper number, that we can find the proper number of constraints so that ensure the proper number of propagating degrees of freedom. So I'm going to first start with the equations of motion, and the equations of motion are first the zero torsion condition, which is basically obtained by varying with respect to the connection, and then the usual Einstein-like equations, which are obtained by varying with respect to the field Fierbein itself. So here G is what's called the Einstein 3 form, T is the mass term 3 form, and all the rest is D is the exterior derivative. And nabla is the covariant exterior derivative, basically. So here we see that we have 40 equations for 40 dynamical fields. So we will see how these equations actually imply constraints and reduce the number of dynamical degrees of freedom. So first of all, we can easily see that by doing this space-time decomposition of the different forms that appear in this way, so for a particular time coordinate, the equations of not all the equations of motion actually involve time derivatives. So the spatial parts of the equations of motion are actually primary constraints. And this leads, so this is 12 constraints, this is 4 constraints, so we have 16 primary constraints. Yes. Okay, so sorry, this is a space-time decomposition of, so I take any P form, and basically this part is the part that contains dt, and this part is the part that only contains dxi. Yeah. So yeah, I should have stressed that. So yeah, now when we take the spatial part of the equations of motion, by definition, they don't contain time derivatives. So they are constraints. Now, we have to look at secondary constraints by the usual procedure, and the secondary constraints are obtained in this pretty elegant way, in my opinion. First of all, by using basically covariant curls of the primary constraints in a way. So a nice way to write the first set of secondary constraints is in this way, where you take the anti-symmetrized wedge product of the Einstein form with the Fierbein, and it actually can be expressed as the covariant curl of the torsion, so it is zero on shell. So yeah, maybe I have to say that this wiggly symbol means on shell. So when the equations of motion are verified. And by using the Einstein equations, it just gives that Tm, the mass term 3 form anti-symmetrized wedge product with En is zero on shell. And this is a constraint. This does not contain any derivatives and can be put on this form. So this is the first set of secondary constraints called the symmetry constraint. Now we have another set of secondary constraints which are obtained by taking just the covariant curl of the Einstein equation. And this is also zero on shell because of this identity. And by using Einstein, And it is actually that the covariant curl of the mass term 3 form is 0. And this, by reusing the equations of motion, can be shown to not contain any derivatives also. T is it's the analogous of the energy momentum. So basically, the vector constraint is obtained as usual in massive gravity, I would say, and has this form where basically the notations are not very important. This MN is some two form involving E's and F's, and KMN is what's called a contortion. So it's the connection minus the fiducial Levi-Civita connection, and this gives. So I have six constraints, six symmetry constraints, four vector constraints, and it gives me 10 more constraints. And finally, I can go to tertiary level. So tertiary level, so every time you take derivatives of the previous constraints. So now we take the derivative of the symmetry constraints, and we get this, which is the contortion wedge EM FN. And of course, not all of these equations are actually constraints. The purely spatial part is not a new constraint. So you only have three constraints here. And then you can also take the curl of the vector constraint, which gives you another constraint called a scalar constraint, and which is the one that that appears in DRGT and that makes DRGT so such a nice theory. It's the one that's responsible for killing the BD ghost. Of course, this is not completely clear that this does not contain time derivatives, but a careful analysis can show that on shell, this term is not dangerous. So this gives four more constraints. And then in total, we started with 40 fields. We had 16 primary constraints, 10 secondary constraints, and now we have four more tertiary constraints. So in the end, we have 10 degrees of freedom left, which corresponds to the 5 physical degrees of freedom that are supposed to propagate in a massive spin 2 field. Yes. Yes. Sorry? Yes. 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 Exactly. But so I skipped some details here. There are some branches where you cannot impose it because This thing does not give exactly this. It gives this times some operator, which is not always invertible. But in a first approximation, yeah. Okay, so what we did in the first paper with Andrew Waldron and Stanley Deser is try to see if superluminal propagation happens in this theory by using this covariant expression of the constraints. And actually, what we did was try to see if wavefronts are allowed to propagate along space-like hypersurfaces. So to do this, we just studied superluminal shock solutions, so solutions of this type, with this vector here being very big and time-like. So this basically selects only the highest order derivatives in the equations of motion and constraints. And derivatives of the constraints. So this can also be seen as studying solutions which have discontinuous normal derivatives along some spatial hypersurface. So it's exactly a reformulation of a shock solution. And what it does is that this effectively linearizes the theory and the constraints about some background. So this is what motivates the next part of my talk, which will have to do with linearization over solution of massive gravity. Of course, here there's always the question of with respect to which metric you define what time-like means. So you can either use the background, the fiducial metric, or the dynamical metric. But results are somewhat analogous. Okay. Yeah, it's true. So we did it. So yeah, we did it for for the dynamical metric, actually. But you can always think if the fiducial metric is Lorentz, you can always say, oh, but I like Lorentz and I want to stuff to be time space like with respect to Lorentz metric, you know. So you can, I mean, I think the first thing you might want to do in these situations by with the understanding that the fiducial metric is some sort of background metric is look at fiducial, but we did it in that paper. We did it with respect to the dynamical metric. Here we will have a slightly different approach in the following. I'm going to talk about. Yeah, I mean the results are analogous with the expressions are different. Okay, so now I'm motivated why we are interested in looking at perturbations about some solutions of MGR, because basically linearizing and taking the characteristic matrix, or just taking the characteristic matrix, or just doing this superluminal shock propagation analysis comes to the same thing, basically. But I think this way of looking at things may make things clearer. So what I do, I take the action for DRGT massive gravity and just replace the E's and omegas by some background solution, which I will call, so background is different from fiducial, yeah. So it's just a solution of massive gravity. And I expand over the solution with some perturbations, epsilon and lambda. And of course, the quadratic action will be something like this. And as I said, yes, it's very important to notice that these guys here are a solution of the fully nonlinear system of equations of motion and constraints. Okay, so now, of course, we can do exactly the same story by just linearizing the equations of motion now. And we would obtain something like this. So this would be the analogous of the torsion-free condition. This is the analogous of the Einstein equation linearized. Tau is the linearized part of the mass term 3 form. And of course, I can do the constraint analysis. First, I take the spatial part of these equations of motion. I find primary constraints. Then I take curls of these primary constraints. I find secondary constraints. This is the analogous of the symmetry constraint. Yeah, and this is just the linearized vector constraint. And then I can do that at tertiary order too, but I won't write it because the expressions become bigger and bigger. And so why do I want to do this? Well, because I want to do this characteristic matrix analysis. So what is the characteristic matrix? I'm going to try to explain it very quickly. So it comes from the basic question that if I take a hypersurface sigma defined by some function phi equals 0 with some normal vector c, I ask the question whether the Cauchy problem for the perturbations is well defined. Or in other words, does the system of PDEs plus constraints, because it's a constraint system, determine the normal derivatives d phi epsilon and d phi lambda as a function of epsilon, lambda, and their tangential derivatives on sigma? So can I actually propagate in any initial condition from this hypersurface? So this allows me, with this these conventions, I can rewrite the system of PDEs written schematically like this, yeah. Of course, there are also the constraints, but suppose I have included them here. I can rewrite it, and by a simple change of variables, I have this matrix times the normal derivatives equals some right-hand term, where this matrix depends on the background solution considered, and this one depends on the background and the perturbations. Okay, so we call this matrix here, so the matrix that that you read off from the equations of motion by looking at the coefficient, basically, of the normal derivatives of the perturbations. We call this the characteristic matrix. And the idea is simple. If chi, this characteristic matrix, is invertible on sigma, then this is a necessary condition for having a locally well-defined Cauchy problem. Locally, I mean in some open neighborhood on the hypersurface sigma. If chi is non-invertible at some point, then chi is called a characteristic. Then sigma is called a characteristic surface. So here, the way I introduce these this characteristic matrix, we can see that it's closely related to the kinetic matrix for perturbations. So this may be important. This will be important for something I will say in the end. And also very important is the fact that starting from if I consider a background solution that on sigma has a configuration that makes chi makes the characteristic matrix invertible, and then I continue, I propagate the theory for perturbations and reach some other hypersurface sigma prime, it may well be that on sigma prime the characteristic matrix becomes non-invertible. So you know this is why the Cauchy problem is only locally well defined. So it may be that I propagate to some other hypersurface that from which I cannot propagate anymore. And this, because of this remark related to chi being closely related to the kinetic matrix for perturbations, this is a sign of strong coupling. So the perturbations become strongly coupled when they hit that surface. Also, another important property of this characteristic matrix is that if I take the equation determinant of chi equals zero and solve it for the components of the normal vector that I introduced for psi, for the components of psi, this determines the causal structure of the theory. So it it determines basically the light cone of the theory in a certain sense, the causal cone, which can be more complicated than just a cone. It can be something that has more than one sheet. It can be more than one cone, basically. And by definition, a hyperbolic system is a system where this equation has the maximum number of real solutions, basically. So it has as many real cone sheets as there are field components, basically. But this is what happens if all these real cones, I mean, if the cone is flat, then it's basically a limit where you have a complex solution.
No, I meant a different relation. Suppose you have
one cone. Okay. Yeah, no, I see what you mean. I see what you mean, yeah. Yeah. So that's a good question. I think we should So the mathematical definition doesn't say anything about these about how the different cones are related to each other. But I think indeed in order to have a hyperbolic system you need these cones to be included in a bigger cone. Otherwise, yeah, but I think that you might be able to, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It might be that you may be able to construct pathological situations when you have cones that that are like this.
There is no such thing as different cones for different fields in our world because fields talk to each other. They interact. But there is no such thing as the maximum speed of propagation for the up quark and the down quark and the photon, etc. This is an illusion of just working in three fields, right? When since they interact and they transform into each other, it's just
but. But the thing, but yeah, But it's strange because the characteristic matrix that you find in the case of just linear perturbations is the same that you would find if you would do the, I mean, it's exactly the same definition that you would have for the fully nonlinear system, basically.
You mean that in a theory where I have different maximum speeds and different species, and all these species I can just set to zero
all. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the nonlinearity is there through a background, exactly. How big is this matrix? It's as big as the number of fields, basically.
Okay, but how many fields do you have?
I have 40.
It's not only gravity, right?
Oh yeah, I see. No, I see what you mean. So if you consider other like coupling to matter or something. Yeah, I mean, but we don't know the theory of how this thing couples to matter. I mean, I think there will be some talks about different solutions to this, but then, yeah, I think this method would work too. You would just compute the whole characteristic matrix. I don't think it's a problem to consider linearized perturbations over some background, because the background contains all the information of the nonlinear theory. Yeah. Yeah. No. That. I mean, it's true. It's true. Okay, maybe I mean, this is not the purpose of my talk to talk about how this couples to other fields, because I don't know how this couples to other fields. But it is true that if did, yeah. But. Yeah, but the nonlinearities are here in the background solution, no? No, I understand, yeah, so the linearities, yeah. But it's still, this characteristic analysis should work even, I mean, it works even if I consider the fully nonlinear theory. So, and we find exactly the same matrix. This is just an easy way of interpreting it, I think. It gives you, and I think it's related to this, yeah, maximal speed of propagation, like Andrew said. But I mean, it gives you the yeah, but in the fully nonlinear theory, it gives you the speed of basically superluminal shocks, basically. Or superluminal shocks in the fully nonlinear. Yeah.
When you set to zero, but you have to consider the entire background, which is also made by other fields, if you really want to
study. Okay, maybe we can talk about it afterwards, but.
We have simple examples where you can get things wrong by just looking at one field. Look at n equals 2 supergravity. Condensacy broken, zero cosmological constant. I mean, to discover that theory is causal and propagates in the light cone, you need to take into account all the fields of the theory, not just the speed they have.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's true. So it is true that maybe things when coupled to other fields, but yeah, it is possible. It is possible. I cannot rule this out. But I have a couple more things to say, and then maybe we can talk about it later. Sorry?
The point of
Yes. I mean, I'm assuming that I have a background now. I don't assume anything about its properties for the moment. Of course, I will have to assume something about its properties in order for the equation to be well posed. The equation, even for the perturbations around that background. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, for a genetic background, of course, there will not be a problem with
it. I mean, so for a genetic background on a generic hypersurface, you might say that there may not be problems, but then nothing ensures you that you don't propagate to another hypersurface where something bad happens. I mean, there are examples of theories that propagate from one hypersurface where things are well posed and then get to some other hypersurface where the Cauchy problem breaks down. Yes, so I'm going to talk about it if I can finish. Yeah. Okay. So now, because I did this perturbative analysis over some background, I will and because I have basically a linear equation, I will do an analogy with the Rarita-Schwinger model, which is a linear model for spin 3/2 particles. So here. This is the usual Rarita-Schwinger action, and where psi is basically psi mu is a vector spinner, and this d operator is here, and of course the equations of motion are obtained by varying with respect to psi and give you this, and here you have, so since psi is a vector spinner, you have 4 times 4 field components. So you need constraints in order to propagate the right number of degrees of freedom. And these constraints come from the primary constraints, which are obtained for mu equals 0 here. For mu equals 0, there's no time derivatives. And then I have secondary constraints by taking the divergence with this operator of this equation, which also contains no derivatives. So I have 8 constraints. This gives me 8 degrees of freedom, which correspond to 4 physical degrees of freedom. OK, so people have known for a long time, since the article of Villon and Zwanziger, that there's peculiar propagation properties about the Rarita-Schwinger, and this can be seen by computing its causal structure, by basically computing its characteristic determinant, and seeing that this characteristic determinant here, in a background electromagnetic field, has 2 different cone sheets. So one which is the usual cone sheet with respect to Minkowski, and the other one, which is this extraordinary cone sheet, which can be space-like, actually, as we can see from this equation, where by boosting to an appropriate frame, we get this determinant to become 0. So this means what we were talking about, that different modes propagate on different cone sheets, and some of them can be wider than Minkowski. So this is a behavior that's also seen in crystals. So the idea is to do the analogy with MGR, with linearized perturbative MGR, by making the analogy between the vector spinner and the perturbations. The A mu electromagnetic background will be the background over which we expand, and the eta mu nu fiducial metric in Rarita-Schwinger will be the fiducial Fermat, basically. And then you find the same propagation peculiarities as in spin 3/2. And you can show that you have a hyperbolic regime with different propagation speeds for different modes. So I don't know if I have time to say, to answer to your question completely. Maybe I'll show it very quickly. So here, by using this analogy, and if I just work in this special parameter space part, which is the beta 2 equals beta 3 equals 0 part, so the most well-behaved part of the theory in a way, and take the fiducial Fermat to be flat, then I can write the characteristic matrix for a time like C mu, so for a space like sigma, and this will be shown here. This appears like this, which with very complicated expressions here and here. What's important is that this characteristic matrix is can be decomposed into an identity matrix, a block identity matrix, and another more complicated one. So this shows that there are also two cone sheets, basically, one corresponding to this identity matrix, which will be, which will just be the usual cone sheets of Minkowski, the Minkowski light cone, and the other one, which is which will be an extraordinary cone sheet, which may be different from Minkowski. And the question is, can this cone sheet be space-like? So can this this extraordinary branch propagate faster than light? And in order to do this, I decompose the contortion into an electric and magnetic part. Then I choose a background such that the knot part of E is zero, of spatial E is zero, and the electric part of the contortion is zero. And then I roughly find the characteristic determinant to be something like this, which is kind of reminiscent of the B squared, the one minus B squared structure of Rarita-Schwinger. And then you can do the same boosting argument as Valens-Wanziger did in order to basically show that this second extraordinary cone can actually be larger than the Minkowski cone. E naught is, so first it's bold E naught, so it's the spatial part of E, the zeroth spatial part of E, basically. Yeah, E zero I, yeah. I just look at the special background to make the calculations easier, because otherwise this thing is impossible to compute. I mean, Sorry? Yeah. I mean, it's E0i, yeah? Yeah. No, not E0, it's E0i. Yeah, so this is basically the main result, and I think I can stop here, but I will just say that supraluminality is different from acausality, because acausality appears when the system ceases to be hyperbolic, so when you cease to have the real cone sheets, when you just have supraluminality, as showed in this paper and others, you don't have acausality actually. But there are choices of backgrounds, and I think Keisuke will talk about it. You reach this breaking of hyperbolicity and you can construct closed time-like curves. Okay, so I will conclude here because I think I would need to be superluminal to finish. Thank you. Yeah, so that's, sorry? Oh, the team mu which would create this background? Yeah, I think it is a reasonable background. I think in the literature that many backgrounds have been studied, and some of them, you know, diagonal, with diagonal structures and stuff like that. I haven't looked into detail to see if I can actually construct it by hand, so I agree it's a good question, but I mostly wanted to get something that's easily that gives an easy expression in the end, because otherwise that matrix is so complicated that it's very difficult to say anything.